Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear some more of Professor Richard Wolff's long and brilliant lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Last week, Wolff explained the major causes of our present economic pickle. Various factors reduced demand for labor in the U.S. Profits rose, but wages stagnated, so workers worked longer hours and went deep into debt. The situation was unsustainable, and around 2007 it collapsed. Today we'll hear Wolff focus more on the CEOs and financiers, and how much of what they did made the situation still worse and harder to fix. Wolff shows us why there is no easy fix, but he does end today with some practical suggestions, plus the very sensible proposal that we stop treating corporate capitalism as a given and ask ourselves, can't we do better than this? Here is Professor Richard Wolff.
What happened to the business community when it was making all this money? It got really excited. It got excited, and it should have gotten excited. This was like a windfall. This was like a dream, a fantasy of business come true. So what did the business community do when they were able to get more and more productivity, more and more from each worker per hour, but they didn't have to pay them anymore? And all that money was coming in. Well, the first thing our business leaders did was to say, you know what this is about? You know why we're making all this money? Because we are really good entrepreneurs. We are spectacular managers. And what do you do for a really stunning entrepreneur and a really profitable manager? Well, you ought to pay them. Starting in the 1970s, the salaries and the bonuses that the boards of directors gave themselves went crazy. I know some of you have gotten upset in recent months as you've heard about companies that are collapsed who are paying their executives tens and twenties and thirties millions of dollars of bonuses. I understand that you're upset. You're just 30 years late. They didn't want to understand, and maybe that's why you didn't know, that the reason their profits went up was because they stopped raising wages. They preferred the explanation, we are managerial geniuses. We should be paid 20, 40, 60, 80 million dollars a year. So they took a lot of the profit and they gave it, surprise, surprise, to themselves. At this point, I'd play the national anthem again. What else did they do? What else did they do? And if you understand this, you'll see much about modern American politics. They used much of the money to move even more production abroad. You know, most of the moving of production to China took place in the last 20 years when all of this was going on. It's very expensive to close a factory in Waltham, Massachusetts, and open it in Tientsin. It's disruptive, it's expensive, it's risky. They wouldn't have done it if they hadn't been flush with the money to make all these changes easily. So they used the money to move the jobs abroad, thereby deepening the whole problem. Here's a third thing they did. They said, we're going to use this money, this profit that we're earning, to reshape American politics. We're flush with money. And over the last 30 years, we are living with the political results. The mass of workers turning inward, remember the bowling alone story I told you, the mass of workers not only withdraw from bowling leagues and PTAs and trade unions, they stopped participating in politics. They lost interest. Politics was no longer a neighborhood store with people with volunteers knocking on the door. Politics is about TV. The government is surrounded by armies of very expensive lobbyists. Increasingly, our politicians have to be billionaires themselves. The rich took over. I live in Manhattan. Our mayor is Michael Bloomberg. He just spent $120 million of his money to be mayor again. He outspent his Democratic rival 11 to 1. So excited were the mass of New York citizens in the mayoral election we just had a couple months ago. I should explain, New York City is an overwhelmingly Democratic city. The majority of people are Democratic registered voters. In the Democratic primary to decide who's going to run for mayor and so on, 11% of registered Democrats voted. 89% of the citizens of New York who are registered Democrats couldn't be bothered, didn't walk the three blocks to the church or the YMCA or wherever the polling place was to do it. But while the American working class was withdrawing from politics to take care of the time of work they had to do and the stresses in the family and their anxieties about debts, while they were withdrawing from politics, in was coming the profit money to reshape the politics. We didn't have a sea change of political opinion shifting to the right. None of that. Stop. We had a mass of Americans quitting, no longer interested, no longer involved, don't give a damn. While a tiny part of our population, collecting an unprecedented amount of money, went in and made politics work for them. And that, too, comes out of the story of the wages and the profits and the relationship between them. And the last thing the business community did with its money was become hysterical. Very important that you understand that. Well, the business community went crazy. In the 1990s, they began to imagine that the stock market was a magical place and you could start a new company and you could go into something called the internet and you could promise that you'd make money in the future and you could sell stocks and people would buy them and bid against each other and make the price go up. It was really exciting. And from 1994 to 2000, the stock market went completely nuts. Everybody knows that. In the spring of 2000, the stock market collapsed when it turned out that a lot of these companies had no prospect of making profits ever, that you had spent $400 a share for a company that wasn't worth 4 cents a share. And then the stock market collapsed. And that's the actual beginning of our crisis, March and April of 2000. The most important stock market in the United States is called the NASDAQ. It's in New York City. It trades in these technological stocks. It hit a level of 5,000 at the index that measures the NASDAQ. Today, the NASDAQ is at 1,800, 1,900. Do you understand? The most important stock market in the United States is today worth less than half it was in 2000. In terms of the long term, the stock market has been in a depression for a decade already. But they didn't stop. So much euphoria, so much money, that when the stock market wasn't an interesting place to play, the hysteria moved to the second place. Housing, building. Suddenly people got completely nuts, threw huge amounts of money to build condos and co-ops and new buildings and a second house and a house with a lawn and a house with a lake. And here's an example of how crazy it got that you read about in the newspaper last week. In the middle of the desert in the Middle East, a group of real estate developers, including a number of Americans, decided to build a new city in the desert. They built new lakes, new roadways, mammoth buildings. The place is called Dubai. And on Wednesday evening of last week, the leader of Dubai, Sheikh something, I don't remember the details of the name, announced to the world that $60 billion that had been borrowed to build this fantastic real estate development, that they couldn't make the payments, they couldn't pay the interest, they couldn't pay back the principal. And so the glittering city in the desert sits there, losing billions and billions. That happened everywhere. All over New York City, where I live, there are half-completed condos, half-completed buildings. No one works on them day after day after day. There's no point in completing these places because they can't sell them. They can't rent them. They can't do anything with them. We went crazy in our real estate. And now we've come to 2007, and what have we got? Well, we've got the results of having postponed for 30 years coming to terms with what happened to change America. The end of rising wages as a payment for people's rising productivity. The workers are exhausted, they can't work more, they can't borrow more, they can't keep up consumption. And the businesses were so extravagant, producing all over the world, building things that couldn't possibly survive. Not only did people get crazy with the investment, but they invented all kinds of new financial instruments. I don't have the time to go into it, but if you'd like, I can do that in the questioning. But I'll give you two examples. A new kind of stock was invented. This was very exciting. When was it invented? The 1970s. It's called an asset-backed security. This is a marvelous thing. You can now buy a share of stock starting in the 1970s that isn't a share of a company that makes anything. Instead, when you buy the share, you get a piece of a group of mortgages. So the Smith family that's making its monthly mortgage payment and the Brown family, they're put together in a little pot. And you, by buying a share of this stock, you get a piece of all those mortgages. You actually get a portion of the monthly payment made by, say, 5,000 families. And billions were issued, and people all over the world bought these shares. But people all over the world aren't stupid, and they worried. They worried, how can I be sure that if I buy this, that the people whose mortgage payments are what this thing is worth will keep up those payments? What happens if they can't make the monthly payment? What happens then? And the American financial industry rose to the challenge. Here's what they did. They said, we're going to issue this new security, this ABS, asset-backed security, is what it's called. We're going to issue it and attach to it, staple to it, an insurance policy. And the insurance policy is going to say, if for any reason anybody who owes money on their mortgage or their car loan or anything stops paying, so the security you have can't pay you the way it is, here's an insurance company that'll make good. The biggest insurance company in the world led the way with American ingenuity. It's called the AIG Corporation, stands for American International Group. They wrote, you ready? Ready? Trillions of dollars of insurance policies guaranteeing these. So then what happened in America in 2007 when the perfectly predictable happened? Suddenly, exhausted American families, indebted beyond what they could do, began to default. They couldn't make the monthly payment on the house. They couldn't make the monthly payment on the car. They couldn't make the monthly payment on their student loans, whatever. Well, at first there was great trembling, but then people said, no, we're okay. We'll go to the insurance company and we'll say, see, they're not paying. You have to pay. That was a great moment. That took place in October of 2008. A whole bunch of New York banks arrived at the headquarters of AIG and said, make good on the insurance policy. And the leader of AIG turned to them with a big smile and said, I don't have the money. Have a nice day. And at that moment, the American government suddenly was staring into the abyss. Because across America, thousands of city, state, and local governments, thousands of pension funds had invested their money buying these securities, counting on those insurance policies. All across America, the administrators of pension funds were getting ready, I worked on some of these, getting ready to write letters to pensioners, old folks, saying to them, we are sorry to inform you that because these asset-backed securities that we bought are now not worth very much and the insurance policy that goes with them cannot be paid off by the company that wrote the policy, we're going to have to reduce your monthly pension from $2,482 to $37.12. At that point, the American government understood that this was not a little crisis, this was not a temporary crisis, that, to coin a phrase, something had hit the fan, and the government had to step in. Is the program of rescuing the banks and spending all this money and borrowing from the Chinese and others, is it working? Well, I think the answer to that is a big not so well. It has helped the banks. They're looking a little better on paper than they did a year ago. But for the average person, for the mass of Americans, it hasn't gotten any better. The unemployment keeps getting worse. The foreclosures keep getting worse. The crises at the fiscal levels of the state all get worse. And indeed, more and more Americans are becoming very aware of it, that some people are getting a lot of help from the government, but I don't seem to be one of them. And the people who are around me, who live in my neighborhood and work in my job, they don't seem to be among those folks either. And you're beginning to see a political separation in America that ought to scare you. Masses of Americans beginning to believe that they are being frozen out, dropped out. This is a population that is getting rageful, and for good reason. It really looks like we've saved the banks and the insurance companies, but the rest of us are on our own. So I don't think it's working. And I think that the president knows it. But think on this as a conclusion. In the depths of the Depression, when things got really bad and the American people got very angry, and do remember in the 1930s, the American anger, the mass of people's poverty and unemployment, made them do something they haven't done now, at least not yet. Millions of Americans joined and became active in the socialist and communist parties in our country. And that made a difference. And that frightened Mr. Roosevelt, and it frightened the business community, because these people were saying, the problem is capitalism, and maybe we ought to get rid of it. So suddenly something had to be done, and suddenly Mr. Roosevelt did things. The first thing he did was to respond to the problem of unemployment in a novel way. He hired people. Mr. Obama hasn't done that yet. Mr. Obama keeps talking about stimulating private enterprise to hire more people, which isn't working, hasn't been working for the last 15 months. Roosevelt tried it, didn't work for him either. So Roosevelt came in and said, okay, the government's going to hire the people. We're not going to have millions unemployed, all the capacity, the machines idle, the raw materials rotting. We have terrible social needs. We're going to put these people to work. We're going to use the material. We're going to produce. People who are working can pay their mortgages, so we won't have the home foreclosures, et cetera, et cetera. So the government came in and hired millions of people. This is not some socialist dream. This is, I'm describing to you what we did in our country by a president who was not a socialist, to say the least. What did he have the American people do? Many Americans I speak to don't know. It's interesting we don't. Let me tell you two things. One was called the Civilian Conservation Corps, a very interesting group of people who were hired for what we would nowadays call environmental work. To rebuild dikes, to redirect rivers, to rebuild foundations in areas that were undercut by water and so on. Many of them built the national parks in the West that many of you visit to enjoy those beautiful parks. Those were built by government-employed, unemployed workers. And the second big program that was really fascinating was called the WPA. The WPA was the following clever idea, just to show you how creative we could be. Artists of all kinds that were unemployed were hired by the government. Singers, actresses, painters, sculptors, you name it, were hired. The government created roving troops of theater people, opera people, whole concert orchestras, and they were sent by paid by the government to rehearse and practice and put on concerts and put on shows of how to sculpt and how to craft and how to whittle wood and all the other things that go into arts and crafts. And it, all across America, in little towns and villages that had never had any cultural activity at all, professional, skilled artists came. The United States never had such a flourishing of cultural activity in its country before, and we've never had it since. Millions of people went to work. Think of it. What an interesting idea. Today, it's not even discussed. So one of the first things I would say is, why are we not looking at the actual things we have done in the past and instead allowing people to go through the pain and the misery, and all of us the loss, of what 15 million unemployed people mean. But I would go much further. And I'm going to leave you with that. I think an economic system that works in the ways I've just gone through with you, that ends up sending money to China, that leaves people unemployed, that leaves people losing their homes. You know, we are a wonderful country. We now have a record number of homeless people, side by side with a record number of unoccupied homes. We are a country in which we line up the homeless people to stare across the street at the empty homes. This is crazy. What is happening here? A society that does that twice in a major way in 75 years, and there were 12 business cycles between the end of the Great Depression and the crisis now. A system as unstable as this, as costly socially as this, is a system that this population ought to have the courage to question. The Cold War is 20 years behind us. 20 years ago, Americans were afraid to question capitalism because that might make you disloyal and be a proponent of communism or socialism. The socialism and communism of Russia is over, of Eastern Europe is gone, and the Chinese look more like us every day anyway. So maybe now we can have the courage to say, can't we do better? Can't we do better than this? Do we have to live with this? What would be an alternative? Suppose we organized business differently in the United States. Instead of having the majority of people in every job come to work Monday through Friday, do the work, go home, leave behind the work they do, so that the people who make the decisions what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits, are whom in our culture? The board of directors of a major corporation. What is the board of directors? 15 to 20 people, that's the average number. And who puts them in that position? The major shareholders, about 15 or 20 people usually. 15 or 20 people select the board of directors, 15 or 20 people, who tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, where to do it. Suppose we reorganized businesses in America so that it worked like this. Monday to Thursday you come and you do whatever your job has always been. Friday you come to work, but you don't do your regular job. Instead, all day Friday you and all the other workers have the following job description. You sit around all day and have meetings, and there you decide together what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. No board of directors, no shareholders. Wow! Guess what would have happened in the 1970s if businesses were run like that? You think the workers would have stopped raising their wages? Unlikely. You think the workers would have moved production out of the country? Unlikely. Our entire economic history would have been completely different. Now, is this a pie-in-the-sky crazy idea that could never work? I don't think so. And here's my proof. Over the last 50 years, groups of American workers have been doing exactly this every year. Many of them. But I'm going to give you one example. It's in a place called Silicon Valley. It's a wonderful part of California, just below San Francisco, running south along the bay to San Jose. It's the center of the computer and telecommunications industry of the United States, indeed of the world. Every year, the following thing happens. Engineers, people who specialize in making software but also some hardware, quit their jobs. They're working for companies like IBM and so forth, big traditional companies with a board of directors that makes all the decisions. They quit the company. They're making good money.
Wolf tells us the engineers can't stand how the company is run, and they can't stand their working conditions. And they say,
so I quit. And together with other people who feel like me, we're all going to take our laptops and we're all going to gather in Harry's garage. And there's going to be a new rule in our new little business. No board of directors, no shareholders. Nobody tells anybody else what to do. We all get together, and Monday through Thursday, that's where I got the example, we come to work and we make software. And on Friday, we don't come to work to make software. We sit around and we decide what to do, how to do, where to do it, when to do it, and what to do with the profits. And when you ask these people, why do you do this? They say two things. I'm a much happier person working in that situation, and I'm much more productive. And I actually went with students and interviewed them. I learned fascinating things. Most of these people are Republicans. And when I tell them, you know, this moving away from a capitalist enterprise and organizing a collective enterprise, that pretty much summarizes the proposal made by this German fellow years ago named Karl Marx. They look at me as if I had just urinated on their shoes. They're really disappointed. They're very unhappy. They don't want to know what I just said.
Richard Wolff, reminding us that communal alternatives to capitalism can work, indeed are now working, in that bastion of American enterprise, the Silicon Valley, among other places. This week and last, we heard large portions of Richard Wolff's long and brilliant lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan, from December 2009. That's before the Occupy movement proved that many, many Americans have a similar vision of what's wrong with the present. Wolff also discusses the past, exactly how we got into this mess, and some practical things we can do to make the future work better than the present does. If you're hankering to see Wolff's entire 2-hour presentation, you can find the video on YouTube. Or just click on the handy link you'll find on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thanks for listening. It'll get to my non-carborundum, Imagine Alternatives. They've got to work better than what we've got now. And please tune in again next week. Ciao.